Welcome to the decidedly unsultry sounds of the ultra-casual Vandermeer Books Received podcast for early July of 2009. 10 or 12 titles to go through that have come in the mail recently that I find of interest. The first is Tati Val Taja, which I know I'm mispronouncing, which is the amazing magazine from Finland that covers science fiction, fantasy, and horror. My own name for it is just basically the most amazing magazine on earth that I cannot read. Beautiful, wonderful graphics, just amazing coverage, just the kind of magazine we really need in the U.S. That would kind of revitalize the whole idea of how you incorporate literature and fiction into a context that also has a really nice pop culture feel to it. So I'm going to be doing readings from all of these, but in this particular case, I can't really read the Finnish, but I'll give it a try just to amuse my Finnish friends who are probably already amused at the way that I've pronounced the title of the magazine, which I believe means also Starfarer or Starcatcher. So here's a short excerpt from the part on Thomas Ligotti, who's one of the featured writers. Sen sijaan eta hukutasi a diskus sensa pulun frank osta eseta pienen armejan edesta ja pa ta sirtai ijast iku sutin klassisala columbine tailela. Well, if that's not butchery, I don't know what is. Next book is by Emma Bull. It's called Bone Dance. It's from Orb Books. It has kind of a feel of fantasy to it. It says the subtitle is A Fantasy for Technophiles. On the back it says, Sparrow is my name, trader, dealmaker, hustler some call me. I work for the Night Fair circuit, buying and selling pre-nuke videos from the world before. I know how to get a high price, especially on big band collectibles. Which seems, to be absolutely honest, to be a very, very specific detail for a back cover thing, the bit about the big band collectibles. In any event, I really like Emma Bull's work, and here's just a very short excerpt from the book, just kind of The camel bit me. She's really sweet, Cher said as I rubbed my forearm. You just don't want to ignore her. You're darn right, the camel pulled her lips back blissfully once more. Josh's brand of tiptoeing wasn't verbal. It wasn't even tiptoeing, really. It was a different kind of caution, another sort of concern for my mental state, and it manifested itself in watching me. I'd known he was doing it, but I hadn't known how thoroughly he was doing it until he stopped. I brought it up one evening in his surgery, where he'd had an emergency call. Large Bob Bear had broken his left wrist. I assisted at the cast-making. Josh's principles of doctor-patient formality were, based on this example, a little slippery. Large Bob referred to the doctor as Josh, you son of a bitch, and Josh addressed the patient as Mr. Bear, you horse's ass. We were alone, and I was gathering up the last ends of plaster gauze and the pan of chalky water when I said, Did you think I was going to kill myself? Josh looked up from his dishpan, full of scary stainless steel implements. I wasn't sure. I didn't know you before, you see, but I knew while I was sealing up the outside of you that something inside was broken. Next up, Dragons of the Hourglass Mage by Weiss and Hickman from Dragonlance, Wizards of the Coast. And as you might expect, it's the Volume 3 of the Lost Chronicles, and here is a short excerpt from it. Rasselin sat before the kitchen fire, listening to the water bubble in the tea kettle, and he thought of those days alone on the road, their small cooking fire blazing beneath the greater, more glorious fire of the sun. Karaman would sit on a log or a boulder or whatever happened to be handy, holding the clay mug in one big hand that almost engulfed it, sprinkling the herbs from the bag into the water, measuring out the leaves with care and intense concentration. That's probably one of the more contemplative elements of the thing, since it looks like it's actually quite action-packed. Next up is, I think, a kind of an underrated writer who I haven't gotten around to talking about on Amazon or on my blog. And that's Brenda Cooper, whose Wings of Creation will be coming out in November from Tor. And I have this advanced uncorrected proof. Here's a short section of it. Actually, I should give you a War is brewing in a strange, exciting world where men and women have the power to fly. So here's a short section. Alicia pursed her lips in brief disappointment, but when she looked back at Tassau, it was gone. I had a sudden vision of her with her invisibility mod on, so that a set of wings flew by themselves and had to cover a smile. Maybe he was in for more than he bargained for. "What do I need?" she asked. "Just tie your hair back and be comfortable." She nearly floated up the stairs. "How will you teach her?" I asked. "We have wings designed for regular humans. Within a day or two, we can teach her to use them, and then she'll be able to fly by herself." I hadn't seen any of these, not last night and not out of the window this morning. You'd think that at least the failed flyers we'd seen at the feast would use them. "What do they look like? Are they safe? Since you don't need them, will you be a good teacher and keep her safe?" "They don't look like our wings, of course. They attach to your arms and legs and across and up and down your back. Don't worry, it's almost pleasant." He grinned. "People come to Lopali from all the worlds. Mostly they come to fly. Our atmosphere makes this possible. For example, for humans to fly on Silver's home takes equipment that is nearly as large as a person and bulky, or it takes engines. Here you don't need either." Kind of intriguing. Next up, David Weber, by Heresies Distressed, best-selling author of the Honor Harrington series. And basically, the battle for the soul of Planet Safehold has begun. And there are empresses and genocidal aliens and all kinds of things of that nature. And here's a short excerpt. "Most of the individuals shot buried themselves harmlessly in the dirt. Of those which didn't, only two actually hit human beings. One man's head simply disappeared. The other jerked to his feet, screaming as he stared at the shattered, spurting ruins of his left arm. But horses and draft dragons were much larger targets than human beings, and Doyle realized instantly that he hadn't had them move far enough to the rear when he deployed his own guns. At least half a dozen horses went down in the first salvo, most of them shrieking like tortured women at the sudden unexpected agony they had absolutely no way to understand. The sound twisted a man's nerves like pinchers, yet the dragons were worse. The high-pitched, agonized howl of a wounded dragon was indescribable. The whistling, ululating scream seemed to fill the universe, and injured beasts lunged frantically against their pickets." Action-packed stuff, as you might expect. A little bit of a change of pace. Brooks Hansen, one of my favorite writers, who's the chess guard, and I can't recommend highly enough, it's on my top 10 list for novels of all time, has a new novel out from Norton called John the Baptizer, which is, well, as you might expect, about John the Baptist, and basically narrates the epic of John's life. Now, I can't say that I actually have much of a taste for things that are based on the Bible like this, and of course, Anne Rice gives us a really bad example with her Jesus Christ stuff. But I kind of trust him to do a good job with this. Here's a short excerpt. "The sixth day it rained through the night. The morning of the Sabbath the clouds were still slung low and heavy, but as the sun ascended, pockets of blue were punching through. The air was redolent of the scent of willow, and for a time a rainbow appeared, extending over the valley like a bridge. It drew the disciples out from their caves, those who weren't already down among the pilgrims. John stepped out as well to meet the colors and fragrance of the day, and the play of beams and light shafts shifting through the clouds. Across the way, the Nazarene was sitting in his usual place. John gave welcome to all. He descended to the water and led them in his morning prayer, the same as he spoke every Sabbath morning." Anyway, this is fairly ambitious stuff. Again, I don't know if it's going to hit my personal sweet spot, but I know it's going to be good regardless. Now for something completely different, from Orbit, The Dwarves, the international fantasy bestseller by Marcus Heitz. For countless millennia, the dwarves of the Fifthling Kingdom have defended the stone gateway into Girdlegard. Many and varied foes have hurled themselves against the portal and died attempting to breach it. No man or beast has ever succeeded until now. And here's a short excerpt from what really is, we're getting into kind of Tolkien land. If I mispronounce anything, it's on me, obviously. "Roll up, Mifredanians, roll up for Theater Curassium, and learn the truth about Nudine the Knowledge Lusty. Witness the grisly circumstances leading to his reincarnation as Nodon the Doublefold and resulting in Girdlegard's demise," he called stirringly. "Marvel at our celebrated actor, the fabulous Rodario. Be transported by Fergus, the best prop master in Girdlegard. Allow yourselves to be spirited away to a world where the sun always shines." The man took a sip from his hip flask, seized his torch, and sent a tongue of fire crackling over the townspeople's heads. My Myfurtians, for one orbit only, this rare entertainment can be viewed in our magnificent theater for the bargain price of 3 small coins. Don't delay a moment longer. We won't be performing tomorrow if the orcs have their way. There was scattered laughter from the crowd as he mimed his own beheading. And mention of orcs brings up the fact that, like the book Orcs by, I believe it was Stan Nichols, this features a rather pissed-off-looking dwarf with a scar descending from his eye like a railroad track on the cover. So they're definitely looking to cover all the traditional bases in this sense. Next up from Orbit also, and Orbit, I must say, is one of my favorite publishers right now. I just think that they kick ass, and I just love the way that they market their books, even the ones that, like the Dwarfs one, which may not hit my personal, be on my personal list of things that I really, really want to read. But they've also just released Ian M. Banks' Against a Dark Background, which is wonderful, because when I first came across this book, I really didn't connect with it because I was so used to the culture stuff, and since I'm away from the culture stuff enough now, I can go ahead and read this probably without that kind of interference. So here's a short excerpt. He looked up at the barred ceiling of the cage. Of all the things he could ever imagine doing in his life, squatting in a stinking cage surrounded by the rotted, half-eaten corpses of glide monkeys, in the middle of the night in the remotest, most backward part of Mykens, drugging an animal the size of a light aircraft while an accomplice interfered with the beast's genitals would not really have been the first to leap to mind. Wow, that sounds quite intriguing. And then next up is Wicked City Blackguard by Hideyuki Kikuchi. And this is from Tor. It's, I guess, in their new line of manga-related novels. I mean, it is a novel. It's presented in the same form as normal manga. And I suppose that's because that's what its tradition is. But it's kind of funny, really, because this could have been published in any particular way. This is the North American debut of the classic novels by the writer of Vampire Hunter D. And let's see, just going through it. Well, this really looks like it's not going to be my cup of tea. There's a lot of gross old men and stuff, like basically groping women. Jeez. Here's a line. The woman had turned into female sex organs. Okie dokie. Yeah, I'm having trouble finding a section here that I can read that I'm just kind of randomly going through that's not completely R or X rated. Let's see. Well, I'm just going to randomly pick something and we'll see what happens. Mackie's magic breath spread gently over Machiko's white skin, becoming a tongue, caressing and pleasuring her body in ways that no man could ever hope to rival. Mackie's? I think it's supposed to be Mackie, watched the other woman's pleasure, and her eyes were so beautiful yet utterly terrifying. An interesting battle, fingers versus tongue. Mackie's lips pursed again, and Machiko slumped back against the sofa, unconscious. Yep, wow, yes, lots of groping and inappropriate touching and the funny thing about it, I guess, is that it's just like just kind of very nonchalantly put into the text. Wow, three men pleasured themselves with Mackie's body, so on and so forth, blah 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 blah, fluids, snake tongue fluids, breast fluids, nipples, saliva, blue blood. Gross. I mean, I don't have any problem with sex scenes in the normal context or something, but this just looks really like something between soft and hard porn with some story thrown in for good measure. I don't really think this is my thing. And now that I think about it, I also remember seeing the anime of Wicked City and not being that impressed with it either. So, not to make any value judgments, I'm sure it's a lovely book. Next up is Paul Tremblay's The Harlequin and the Train, a novella from Necropolitan Press, and comes with some nice blurbs from Laird Barron, among others. It's a beautiful book as artifact, just in the way that they've made it look like a exercise book from class. And Here's a short excerpt. I don't really know what this is about. I can't find the press release. It's one of those books you can't really tell just by looking at it. You don't remember? Rudy's voice gets loud again. He shakes the figurines. The clink of porcelain sounds like a flipped coin landing or a distant long-ago car crash he never heard but has spent most of a lifetime imagining, with the blood vessel bursting in Karen's head. He closes his eyes but still sees, and he's scared and tired and angry and everything at once. He's back to wanting and needing to lose control. Karen scoots backwards on the bed, pressing herself against the headboard. Please don't get loud again. He runs back to the chair adjacent to the bed and Karen. He stares at the figurines, looking into their eyes, looking for an answer. He sticks the figurines in front of Karen's face, keeps them there until she picks her head up and looks at them and looks at him. Red flushes her cheeks and tears fill her eyes. I really like Tremblay. I think he's a really good writer. The only unfortunate thing about this copy is that there's no real description of the book on the cover, or inside cover, and I can't find the press release, so I think that's a little bit of a mistake, but otherwise I quite like it. And Cage Baker, Not Less Than Gods, coming out from Subterranean Press in December. Throughout the company series, there were occasional references to a mysterious group operating during the Victorian era. Their origins were supposedly lost in the mists of time. Their members included Leonardo da Vinci and Dr. John Dee, and so this is kind of a company novel and kind of not. It's really about this secret group, and it has a really lovely steampunkish cover. It's illustrated by J.K. Potter, excuse me. And here's a short excerpt. I really love, by the way, Cage Baker's work. I think that she is a very underrated writer, no matter how much attention she gets, and she's one of the only writers I know also who can do slapstick really well. She had a story about that involved a parrot in a cage that was one of the best bits of slapstick on paper that I've ever seen. It's really hard to write slapstick. It's a lot easier, I think, to show it visually, obviously, because it's motion. But she does a great job with that. And all right, so here's a short bit. Instead, each man held in his slack hand a tool of some kind, chisel or shovel or mattock. Each man's face was individual, distinct, yet all were gray, lined, and exhausted-looking, and all had their eyes shut as though they slept. Portraits of the dead. We found them when we were digging here, hiding away our headquarters under the museum. He spoke softly. They were perfectly preserved. They'd been thrown into anaerobic mud, so deep and so cold they never rotted. We autopsied them, we studied them, we made careful drawings of them. We learned all we could from each dead man, but of course not his name. All we could do for them was to give them new burials here, with as much honor and ceremony as we could provide. And there are only six out of the thousands we know must lie all around us. They are martyrs, after all, to the future we wanted to bring to Russia. We think it is good to have them here to remind us of the human cost of our plans. Remember them when you walk the streets in the sunlight above. And finally, we have Larry Niven and Edward Lerner's Destroyer of Worlds, which is a book coming out in November from Tor. And it's the third book in the trilogy set 200 years before the discovery of Ringworld. I don't know where the fun is in that, to be absolutely honest, since there's no Ringworld in this. Nonetheless, here is an excerpt. Sigmund paced the confines of the relaxed room, a bulb of untasted coffee warm in his hand. The digital wallpaper suggested that lush forests surrounded him. Eyes might have accepted the illusion, but his other senses refused to be fooled. The whir and clatter of the ventilation system intruded, and the unyielding plasteel deck beneath his feet, and the taint of air too long recycled. Tanged, but he was sick of this ship. Quickly enough, the crew assembled. Ero, clad in pressure suit and exoskeleton, assumed his usual position on the table. Kirsten and Eric sat side by side along one edge of the table. Baedeker predictably occupied the table edge nearest the hatch, twitching whenever Sigmund's meandering blocked the way to the exit. The puppeteer crept closer every day to collapse. Jeeves, as always, would participate from the bridge. His absence would be no more noteworthy than that few of the Gwoth, and typically only Ero ever ventured from the opaque water tank habitat that largely filled the largest cargo hold. For that real mystery, Sigmund had a theory. The Gwoth recognized that their protective gear and exoskeletons looked a lot like battle armor. Too many of them roaming the ship would look like a boarding party. So there you have it. There's some incoming fiction in book form for review, and relatively varied. I'm not sure about this group. I honestly think that I will probably personally enjoy the Cage Baker and Against a Dark Background by Ian M. Banks. But there's certainly a lot of variety here, and Brooks Hansen is never to be underestimated. He's such a great writer. Thanks. Until next time.